Hello, hello, and welcome to episode 111 of the Eyes Free Sports Podcast. That's right, we've reached the triple one episode here of the podcast. As usual, this is your host, Greg Lindberg. Here on this episode, we are visiting with a gentleman from the Houston, Texas area who has competed in running as well as snow and water skiing at some pretty high levels. In addition, I should mention that in the last few years, he has started an effort to raise funds for both guide dog schools as well as blind sports organizations. So let's go ahead now and dive into episode 111 of the Eyes Free Sports Podcast. Okay, so joining me here on this episode of the podcast is Mike Royal. And Mike is a highly accomplished and talented multi-sport adaptive athlete who has competed at some pretty high levels in several different adaptive sports for the blind. Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Greg. Good to talk with you again.
Absolutely. And I should mention that Mike is one of the few guests I've gotten to actually meet in person. So he and his lovely wife, Wendy, took me out for lunch about 6 weeks ago, maybe, here in Florida. So always love to connect in person with any podcast guests when I get the opportunity. So thank you guys for that.
Yeah, it was fun. I was glad to meet you. And I think it'll make for a better podcast.
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, appreciate the outreach and everything as well. So why don't we just start this episode off here, Mike, just with your background as far as kind of your formative years, where you're from and where you grew up.
Yeah. So like a lot of the prior episodes, I've heard people mention they grew up in a small town, and being ultra competitive that I am, I'm going to say my town's smaller than your town. But no, I grew up in a small town in rural southeast Nebraska. It's about an hour south of Omaha and 30 miles east of Lincoln. My kindergarten class consisted of me and three girls. So Rob and Heidi and Julie, one of you listening, go Cardinals. We, found out when I was in kindergarten, the teacher noticed I had difficulty with dimming the lights and stuff like that. Ultimately, that's when I went over to Iowa City for a day or a day and a half of testing and was diagnosed with RP. So I was diagnosed when I was 5 years old, had the night blindness, early symptoms. My mom's a twin. They're not identical, but two of my first cousins also have RP. They were diagnosed after me. So it's X-linked in my family. I grew up, like I say, going through fourth grade in that little small town. It was kind of interesting. And when I went into first grade, they combined the second and first grades together. And so there's about a dozen of us in the class. And then the next year I was the second grade boy with the first grade boys. And so wow. Every other year was like a whole different group of friends that I hung out with. And that's how I grew up through like fourth grade. Then my parents, they had gotten divorced, and I moved with my mom to Lincoln. It was a little bigger town. I grew up back, spending weekends and stuff on the farm. I did some hunting, some fishing with my grandfather, my dad. Growing up, I tried some, little league baseball. This was before T-ball day, so I never hit anything. Unfortunately, I guess the ball never Charlie Browned me in the outfield. So I don't ever remember anything too dramatic. So that was kind of my ball game days. About when I was 10, I think, was when I first got on some trainer water skis and messed around just on big open body lakes. And ultimately, the first real competitive sport I got in and started loving was wrestling. And I did that in seventh grade. I did that throughout high school. In wrestling, it didn't really have much of an issue because, other than my biggest concern was a tournament was finding the red or green strap to wrap around my leg so they knew how to score the match. So I'd go out there and be concerned I wouldn't see it. And sometimes I didn't. And, was trying to hide my blindness at this point in my life. And but ultimately, I was able to hold the varsity position my senior year at 145 pounds. I made it to the state tournament. I went 2-2 at the state tournament and ended up just missing a medal by one by one win. So, you know, that was kind of, you know, when I got started, it was interesting. My coach, when I made the state tournament, so I've been wrestling with him for 3 years, he must have saw some other blind athletes starting with touching their opponents. And he's like, you know, we could do that. And I thought, you know, this is probably my last 2-3 matches of my life. There's no need to change now. You know, I think we'll probably circle back and you'll give me some other opportunities. But, you know, I'm contemplating here in my mid-50s now. If I'd go back and tell my 18-year-old or my high school Mike, I'd say, hey, you should have a different cheerleader walk you out each match and help you find the strap for your leg. Master a takedown move that would, you know, use my blindness as a competitive advantage instead of, you know, trying to wait till they actually make contact with me to start the match. And, you know, and I think about that, and then I also think my high school Mike probably wouldn't listen to me anyway. So that's kind of how I got started into sport.
Gotcha. Yeah, definitely interesting take on how, in a way, blindness can benefit us, you know, in certain ways as well. So as far as education, so it sounds like you were mainstreamed, living in a small town, I assume.
Yeah, as mainstreamed as we were in Unadilla. But the... and then, yeah, and I went through high school, like I say, my sophomore year, I moved back to and lived with my dad full time and went to high school in the small town. I went consolidated like half the county. And I think we ended up with 50 kids in my senior class. About that time, I didn't really need any accommodations. I could see well enough to read the print and things. I'd sit in the front of the room. That type of thing. I really liked my math classes, and I took accounting my senior year of high school and decided, I'll become an accountant. At about the same time, there was the Foundation Fighting Blindness. I think it was actually called the RP Foundation Fighting Blindness at the time. Was funding a study at the Boston Eye and Ear Infirmary, and I went out and it was taking a large doses of vitamin A, and it was a test group, so I thought, man, this would be awesome. I'm going to go out there and be able to get on this vitamin. It'll slow down my progression, and so, you know, I'll go ahead and pursue the accounting and do it with my vision as much as I was at the time. And after 2 days of testing, they called me in and they're like, did you know you were legally blind already? And I'm like, no. And they're like, well, you're not really a good candidate for our program. And I guess, you know, I don't recall that set me back a whole lot, because I know I went ahead, and that was after my senior year of high school. And I just went ahead and went to the University of Nebraska at Omaha and started my studying to get my business degree.
So they pretty much said, like, you had lost enough vision already, or you didn't have enough vision.
Yeah, I don't think that they qualify. Thought it would, right? It was going to help. I had a few little islands, you know, but the peripheral vision was pretty well gone at that point.
Sure. Gotcha.
But I still, I mean, so I was legally blind, but I still faked it. We'll get there here. It wasn't until about 7 years later that I finally started accepting the blindness piece. I guess we'll get there in a minute. But yeah, so I went, you know, I tell my kids I started with English 101 reading improvement. I was good in math, but I wasn't so good in English, and ended up, you know, we're doing this film strip and they're trying to teach me how to scan my eyes. And that's probably one of the few professors in my whole college career that realized, oh, you got a vision impairment. You probably could have opted out of this class. But I think it had to do more with my spelling than needing my eyes to scan. But it's for the most part, I didn't disclose to my professors, and other than a couple like geography classes, I think one time I took test offline so I could have more time to try to figure out where things were at on the map. Through that time, I started working my sophomore year. I was working about 30 hours a week. I was also training about in 1988, my family was getting ready to go on a snow skiing trip for spring break. And they thought, you better get a little bit better shape, Mike. So I started running a little bit. And then I was also, taking full-time classes. And that's when I ended up, I started running to get in shape for my first time I went skiing in Colorado. We could drive there in about 10 hours or so. And that was, like I say, I wasn't in doing any blind sports per se, but I just go, I started running. I'm sure they told the snow instructor that I couldn't see much. And I'm sure I in turn told them I didn't need any accommodations. And that's kind of how I continued for the next 7 years. We, go skiing snow skiing about once a year, do 3, 4, 5 water days, depending on the farm chores on the lake. But I was starting to run. My stepdad had ran a marathon or two at that point. And once I started running, I did my first marathon in the fall of 88.
Gotcha. And so just to clarify at this time, so you didn't have like a guide when it came to skiing or running?
No, I didn't. I hadn't self-identified, I think, the terms these days, that as a blind person. I would see the big orange blind skier bib, and I was like, I'm not doing that. I would walk around sometimes with a collapsible cane, and I'd, more times than not, it was in my backpack when I ran into something, then they'd running in to find something for me. I look back and, I just dumb. But, that's where I was at the time. Kept running. And I kept wanting to make a Boston qualifying cut time. And also during that time frame, they had started up again, I think it was the RP Foundation Fighting Blindness, and an Omaha chapter they started. And so I would parade out my cane and be the blind media guy and try to help them raise awareness and funds somewhat. And it happened in, 4 years into my marathon career, with several attempts and I never making a cut time for Boston. And I was running the Omaha Riverfront Marathon in the fall of 1992. And the local news truck was there, the van, they're filming me along the course. And I'm sure people were like, who's this guy? At this point, that's just a small marathon. It was pretty easy just to follow the crowd or, with the runners, a few, and I did that. The big obstacle for me on that one was going to be it finished indoors. And so I told my stepbrother, I said, you wait half mile out because if it's close, I don't want to be coming in with the light adjustment, not be able to finish it all the way through the tape. We got done and I ran 3 hours, 10 minutes and 42 seconds. My cut time was 3 hours and 10 minutes.
Wow.
the camera, here's the reporter. How's it feel to miss it by 42 seconds? And I was like, I'd given up on it about 20 miles into it. It was started raining and the wind came up and I didn't realize it was that close. I just said, hey, it wasn't my day. I guess I'll look to try to qualify. Everybody told me Vegas was in spring with a little quicker course. So it's like, well, just here we go again. Yet another, it's hopefully it's worth waiting for.
Yep.
The next day I'm at work and I get a phone call and this lady said, hey, I saw the news story last night and my husband had a similar deal and the Boston Athletic Association, so the BAA, allows a minute for different course starts. You might want to check because you very well could have qualified. So this was internet, I didn't have internet I remember I called them and rode away and sure enough, they were allowed that minute for everybody. So I was like, hey, it's no charity thing. I'm taking it. So I get the entry form and I'm filling it out. And all of a sudden I'm going down there and there's a box that says visually impaired division. I thought, what the heck is that? So I call the BAA again and say, I'm not sure if I qualify for this, but tell me about the visually impaired division. Well, you just need to be legally blind. So I easily met that standard. But so checked the box and went out there. So I think it's the third Monday, Patriots Day in April. And my stepdad, he had qualified too, but he was a little slower than me. So they line you up in chutes back then. And I think they still do, and wave, you know, the start. And he was going to be a couple chutes behind me. And when that gun went off, that was probably the first time I felt like a visually impaired runner, because I couldn't move. It was so crowded. And I was not going to open up for a long time. Wasn't too long. And here comes my stepdad. I mean, he found me in that crowd. It's like, I ended up running about 24 of that of miles with my right arm on his left shoulder, which is not great technique, but it was the only way we're going to get through the course that day.
Wow.
I've got through about, you know, a couple miles to go. It thinned out enough, and I said, I'll catch you at the finish line. I think I finished in about 3.5 hours that day. It was really hot. That's what I remember. And, you know, I was taking every water, taking extra water from kids. Normally wouldn't do that, you know, except for official stations. Got done, and, you know, came home, and, you know, that was awesome. You know, 5 years took to get qualified, ran that thing. And it was a few weeks later, all of a sudden I get this Waterford Crystal Plate in the mail, and it's like third place visually impaired division. I was like, I guess I should have known if I checked the box, there's actually maybe an award. If I was going to change anything there, I probably, the only thing I would have changed is went to the award ceremony, because that'd have been pretty cool to get that plate awarded with all the other champions of the day.
Sure.
But that's kind of how I got introduced then into, you know, almost my first adaptive competition, I guess. And it got me then, I learned about the United States Association of Blind Athletes. I started, I did some race camps with them at the Olympic Training Center, and then traveled with them through to various shorter distant races throughout the United States. My goal was, hey, I wanted to be on the Paralympic team. Long story short, I never made a team. Never made a running cut time. I also, they learned of one, you know, this Breckenridge Outdoor Education Center. And, you know, I'd been snow skiing for about 5 years with my family. We were doing another trip, and I told my brother-in-law, I said, we went to Keystone on Saturday. We skied like we always did, just me kind of following the family. And I was going to give the Boeing blind bib a try. And I figured, you know, it was just something, it was, you know, I'd learn more about the blind athletics and stuff. But I said, I'll meet you at lunch, because if it sucks, I'm skeditching them. Well, it turned out we had a great time with the guides that day. And by the afternoon, they kind of, it was real windy on this peak 10, and they let it opened up, and they just let me rip it pretty good. And I haven't skied without a bib since. And that, for the next couple of years, I tried to make I was running, but also doing some skiing. I'm 95, 96 year, I guess it was. I made it out to, I think, two different tournaments. And then I was able to partition my way into the nationals, because I did well enough. I needed an extra qualifying, but they let me in. And I ended up third in the downhill. But the two guys ahead of me were on the Paralympic, you know, and they were on the U.S. Alpine team. They were not tenths of seconds ahead of me. They were 10s and 20s. I don't know, they were way better than me. And I realized this Nebraska flatlander was not going to be able to, you know, continue to compete without a move. And at the time, I was getting ready to finish up my MBA and start into a career. Well, actually, I had started in January of 94. So I was doing all this while I started into my auditing career. And it was, and that's kind of what my running, I call those my kind of my running and snow skiing days.
Sure. Interesting. So it sounds like you really did kind of realize the importance and benefit in a way of, you know, self-identifying, like you said, finding guides, putting on the bib, just for your athletic career, right?
Yeah, and I think we're going to talk about the guide dog stuff in a little bit, but that was also part of that time frame. Is I got my first dog in May of 1993, and so some of the making the Boston cut time, learning that, putting on the orange bib, it was like, hey, once I get a dog, it's going to be game on. I'm going to be able to stick a black lab in my backpack. I better get ready for all the blind jokes. Well, those blind jokes didn't happen. The athletic stuff is in everything, you know, now 30 years later, it's dealt, you know, it's opened way more doors than it closed. The fact that, I mean, I've heard others on the episodes and everybody comes, at their own rate of pace to, towards accepting the blindness. But for me, that was, once I did, it was less of a barrier than what the mystique or the fear was before I did it.
Right. Absolutely. So then in terms of water skiing, talk to me about your early journey with the adaptive water skiing.
Yeah. Like I said, I did a little bit growing up, but never, did it competitively. Didn't even know what we were doing. We'd go out and be doing things just about backwards, what we should be doing, that I've since have learned. Well, my dad lost a battle with cancer in 2001, and he had his roundabout fishing combination type boat. My sister said, hey, we're not going to use it, but if you want to take it back to Houston, I'd move to Houston by the time, go ahead. And that's, put that up on the big lake and just started skiing. And then at the same time, I learned that they had just came out with this device called the audio slalom signal generator, named the Bat Blaster. A guy from England had invented it. I learned that it would simulate the slalom course that the able-bodied people go through pretty well. I happened to be going to do an audit in London, was able to pick one up and meet Chris Mayers, the guy who invented it. In fact, my first competition I ever did was at a lake in the London area. And I actually, the week before, I learned to jump. And so I actually slalomed, audio slalomed there and jumped. I got, hooked on it pretty quick. I was like, okay, at this point, I kind of realized my running times weren't going to get there. But perhaps I could make the world championship team in skiing. There's not an Olympic sport, so the world championship is the highest we got as far as competition. And so that was my goal, was to come back and train and, use dad's boat and get going. That's kind of a tribute to him. It didn't happen as quick as I thought it would, but I mean, I eventually got there. I've been doing this since the early 2000s, and in 2005, I believe it was. Yeah, it was 2005. I made my first team as an alternate. It was bittersweet because I blew my knee out jumping, and I just made it back to the award ceremony in time to you're an alternate, and it's likely you'd be on the team if somebody else can't make the commitment. But I couldn't. It took me a year of rehab to get back. And it just didn't start getting back. It wasn't until 2009 then when I finally made my first team. We went to France, and I finally felt like, hey, here's the dream, right? I made that level of competition. I remember the coach at the time saying, hey, you made the team, now the hard work starts. And I didn't realize it so much at the time, but I did realize it later, because I didn't contribute any team points and didn't make a finals at my first world championships. The second one, it was in Ohio, and I made the finals and tricks. I think I actually might have got a medal. I think, but my points were so, they didn't contribute to the team points. When what we have is a team of 14 skiers at maximum, and there's a standing division of arm, leg amputees and people with other, they can maybe have all the limbs, but the strength and and two of the limbs are not strong enough to at the able body ski. We have seated skiers and then the vision impaired. So I was, I was gladly accepting the team gold medal with my team, but my contributions were more of a helping to haul gear around than scoring points.
Sure.
I missed the team in 13, which was a wake up call. And then I've been on it 15, 17, 19, and now in 23 as well. And I started at least scoring some team points. I've had six world records on the Bat Blaster, and I finally set a record or tied a world record on the Kronos Audio Slalom. It just, technology got better through the years. This thing measures things more precise than the first generation audio slalom signal generator. Simulates the course even more like the able body skiers do it. And I tied the world record. I happened to do that in Norway in July of 2019 at the World Championships in the finals. My prelims was the worst score to make the finals. So, I went out and skied up my best in my life and had the score for others to chase. Fortunately, it held up, and I actually won the world championship with that score. And wow. Then I was able to back that up last September. And my score was a little lower, but everybody's was. So I was able to back to back world champion. And up to then, I was starting to think my story was going to be, always close, but never quite got there. And then now, it was gratifying to win that. My whole family was there on the dock. Once I had the score, we just sat and waited. I referred to them as the Royal Family Boat Crew. I drugged them. We went to Australia in 17. We've been all over the U.S. It's different things where, your dad's going to go compete again. And so that was a good time. And I'm looking to be back down your way in Urbandale, Florida in September. Will be the team trials, and I'll try to make the 2025 team, which most likely be headed to Australia. So it's I'm not sure when or how many more of these I've got in me, but that's the goal right now. I'd like to, when I tied that world record, it lasted for about less than a month. And Daniele, he's an Italian skier. He went out and rebroke it right away. I was happy that I was able to defend at the, when we went head to head the next time we were back on the same water together, I was able to win for a second time, because I've got a lot of silver medals to Daniele.
Sure. But, wow. Very neat. So as far as that audio system that you've talked about, and I'm sure that's kind of evolved over time, if you could kind of elaborate a little more on kind of how that works and techniques with that.
Yeah. So the normal course, the skiers will come in and they go through entry gates and then look around six buoys and out exit gates. And at 36 mile an hour, the boat travels at and of like 14.16 seconds. And so what they do is when they arm our device, when we simulate going through the starting gate by crossing from the left side of the boat to the right, that starts our time. And then you've got that same amount of time to get, wide enough. Once you get wide enough on the right hand side of the boat, it'll beep. And that's based off of, the angle from the center line that the handle is. And then you proceed over to the left hand side and get wide enough to beep. And this new device, it's right all buoy timing. So it used to be that you could take the whole 14 seconds to get three buoys. Now, if you're not at buoy three time at buoy three, you're done.
Right.
And so that made it, part of what helped. And I think just some of the inner workings of it, a more precise measurement, and that, and so that's how we simulate that, the slalom. And so, at the Worlds and the Nationals, that's when, we're set up for adaptive, but I can go to any, tournament, assuming, they're going to drive the course, and more than most sites, I could probably ski. There's some sites to where if the jump ramp is too close to the course and, I might not be exactly on time, and I'd say it was too dangerous and it would opt out of that site, or we make bigger ways to adjust the start a little bit to help, some things. But other than that, it's pretty much simulates the slalom course really well. I trick yet, I don't jump after that crash in 05. I haven't done that, but on tricks it's pretty simple because you get 2 20-second passes to do as many tricks as you can, and so they just whistle or tap the rope when I pass the part of the lake where I can start the can start section and do the tricks. I was fortunate back in 2021, the regional tournament was fairly close to to my house, and so I thought, let me go there, and if I could stand up on my tricks, I possibly could set the national record, which I ended up doing. And then on the drive home, I realized I ended up top five. I was fourth in the region, and that qualified me for the national tournament, the national able body tournament. And so quickly scrambling around, my daughter, she found some flights, and it was just before she's headed off to her freshman year of college, and we were able to take a last minute daddy-daughter trip to the Chicago area. And actually, I think I was probably the first totally blind participant at the able body nationals. And there were 15 of us in my age group, and I ended up second from last. but I did manage to squeak by one person. But no, it was pretty fun, and especially because I kind of got to spend the time with my daughter and one of our last summers together before she went off to college.
Exactly. Yep. Can't beat that time spent. Cool. Then as far as any other sports for the blind, have you had the chance to try any others or any that you're interested in maybe giving a shot?
I would probably try about anything, but I'm also, right now I'm trying, being realistic, my left knee, my ACL, my PCL are both stitched back together with cadaver Achilles tendons. So I've been trying to do a little run walking lately, and he caught me on a sore knee day. So some of those things, I'm big cutting type sports. I'm not sure at this stage I could do them. I do wouldn't mind doing some more tandem riding. I've done a century years ago. I did a hunt called the Hotter Than Hell here in North Texas, and 100-mile ride. It was kind of fun. Just a buddy of mine, he'd go rent a tandem bike, and we rented it a half a dozen times and figured out, okay, we can probably get through this. Right. And we did. We returned that bike in pretty bad shape. We brought it in with rode the last half mile on the rim, and I think we broke about every spoke. But fortunately, we had rented it enough over the summer. They were okay with it. But so something like that. One of the things. When I hear people doing the Iron Man, that was by one of the bucket lists that won't get done. But from those type of sports. I did. I think we mentioned this when we had lunch together, episode 101, back in November, I actually heard that one as I spent the first time in 30 years out at with my neighbor asked me to go with him, and he was going deer hunting, and I had no idea. I knew some people had done it. I had no idea what to expect or what his setup was. And the morning we were coming home, I catch this Guy and I's Outdoors podcast on the Eyes Free sports podcast. I'm like, what is this about? And yeah. I have had, I contacted Drew Blake and he put me in contact with some other people, and I rapidly found some gear and went back a couple more times and had some success in January on a doe hunt. And so I'm hoping to do some more of that. I'm looking for other opportunities, and I've got some information out on my website, Blind Canine Sports. One of those posts is like making friends and getting the gear, because I put this all together pretty quick, and I think I've got some tips there that people gave me that now it's a kind of one-stop shop if somebody was looking to do something along those lines. I've got some other stuff out there about the skiing and whatnot. I can put you in contact with the Kronos people if somebody wanted to look for their own audio slalom type device as well. But so I'm not, I'm not sure what for now. I'll probably just keep the skiing going and do that as long as I can. I'll go hunting one in the off season, and I wouldn't mind if I could find a 2-3 day long tandem ride. I think that'd be probably about what I could handle these days.
Sure. Got to protect those knees, right?
Yeah, and that's one of those back when I was doing the marathons and stuff more, and people would say, I couldn't do a marathon. And I realized I was actually speaking to a training group one time of just able-bodied people. And I said, it was at their pre-race carbo load dinner. I'm like, when you hear that, that's the people are right. But what they're saying is they couldn't train for it. And you guys already trained, so just go have fun tomorrow. And, and I think that's where I'm not sure. Like I say, I get at some point you got to realize some of the limitations, but that's probably a tough pill for me to really admit, but at some point that's just reality.
Right, exactly. So I know you did mention Blind Canine Sports, which is a super interesting name, and I know it certainly relates to guide dogs and blind sports, and I guess we can kind of start with the guide dog piece. I know you did mention you've had dogs now for a couple of decades. And where are your dogs from? Where have they been from? And just talk to me about your guide dog journey.
Yeah, so Blind Canine Sports, it's something I've just started. Tried to formalize some of the things I've tried to do since I got my first guide dog back in May of 1993. And I've got Cody. He was my first one from Leader Dog in Rochester Hills, Michigan. I had a second dog from there, and when I needed to go get my third dog in 11, I moved to Texas. I didn't want to take time out of the water ski season to get a dog, and I didn't want to go to Michigan in the winter. So yeah. I got that one from, I believe they rebranded it now to Guide, just Dogs Inc., but it's Southeastern Guide Dog. They're near you in Bradenton, Florida. And my last two dogs have been from Podoko out of Connecticut. So I've had good dogs from all of those. I think any of those schools are solid. And, what's your best dog? It's the one in the harness at the time. For me, obviously that first dog, though, I mentioned it got me this. Really, that's when I went from being what, bacon being a sighted person that didn't see very well at all to becoming a blind person that at the time people thought I could see well, right? Because I could still have some central vision. I was working primarily for those years with bigger screens and stuff, but I could still see what I saw. I could see, but it was that tunnel got smaller and smaller until now I'm all voice. But so I've did the Blind Canine Sports guy. I would go do when I was working and traveling as an internal auditor. I traveled all over the world through the sports and through the work. I'd taken dogs to Rio, de Janeiro. I've been had them in Cancun, Mexico, up in Calgary, and all over the United States. The dogs went with me to Norway, and they went with me to France. And that was, very, very cool to have, the dogs. It's just opened up that mobility. Kind of back to that whole, when I qualified for Boston and I started knowing I was going to become I was going to identify as a blind person. I looking back, I now realize that when I finished my undergrad work, I didn't pursue jobs as aggressively as I could have, because I was worried about moving away from the family and support group and travel. But I got Cody in May of 93. I finished up my MBA over that summer and the following fall. And then starting January of 94, I started as an internal auditor with the Union Pacific Corporation, which owned the railroad there in Omaha. And we were based out of Omaha, but we traveled all over the United States. My first two audits were actually in Omaha, but starting with my third one, I think for the next two years or so, I was gone on the road about 80% of the time. And I went from a kind of a small town boy that was worried about the travel into pretty seasoned with a guide dog across the United States. I did one of the interesting stories. When I got Cody, my vision there, we wanted to make sure you didn't override the dog, and we worked out well. I managed to trust him to, to not try to override what I thought might seem like a better path. One of the coolest early stories with him, we got back May of that summer, went to Estes Park, Colorado. So a summer Colorado trip this time, and we went on a hike, and I used to kind of dread hiking, wouldn't see the branches, but just kicking rocks and trip over little cutout, streams and stuff. But we started up this trail, and Cody and I just flew up it. We were, next thing we know, we're above tree line, so we're over 12,000 feet. Then wow. He's just picking his way through this, it's just rocks. I mean, so unless he's just been smelling other, I don't know. Yeah. Eventually, I thought, I better just wait and sit here for a while. And my family, my parents, my stepbrother caught up with me. They're about 45 minutes behind. They said, every time they go, you following that guy with the lab? They say, they're just way ahead of you. And so, we got up there, had a snack or lunch or whatever, and then turned around, and then I got to wait for them at the bottom. And that was just, that was very, it's like, oh yeah, this is cool. The blind canine sports, when I travel, I'd be the auditor, but I'd be the blind auditor, show up and here's this dog. And so I do lunch and learns at the various subsidiaries. What I've found is I used to term it, the people were either uninformed or uninformable, and if someone just didn't know that, and you taught them, and usually most 99% of the time that was all it took. Occasionally you'd find that uninformable person at a new location and refuse the dog, and just things you have to work through, but those are so few and far between that it's been that's been a great ride for me. Back in 2016, after about 2 years of my daughter wanting to raise a guide dog puppy, and me saying, we've got my working dog and my retired working dog, and several times I put her off saying, I'm not sure we can commit to this. One day she said, Dad, if nobody ever raised a guide dog, or if nobody ever raised a puppy, you would never have gotten a guide dog. So, well, let's get that application in. And so her and my wife started raising the puppies back in 2016. Taylor since went off to college, but Wendy still, she's on her seventh puppy now. Wow. And that's actually what had brought us to Florida that time when I had my you for lunch. Is we went back and Grace, puppy number six that Wendy had raised, was being matched with her forever person, and we got to meet. We got a reunion with Grace and meet her forever person that they're now in that 90 days with the school, no contact time, but they're all on their way. I think she's actually in North Carolina, matter of fact, is where she, Grace is guiding her forever person. So my wife has had three of her dogs get all the way to placement, and like I say, she's on seven and right now, and I don't think it's going to stop anytime soon. She is now past me because I've only worked five guide dogs. So,
right.
So it's kind of our way of trying to give back. And you know, what I want to do with the Blind Canine Sports, if you will, is raise awareness and funds for any the blind schools that I've been affiliated with, or, you know, if you go to the About or Help Us page, I know that I've got three schools I mentioned, guide dog schools, as well as the United States Association of Blind Athletes, and then a link to the U.S. Adaptive Water Ski page, because, you know, those are the areas I'm focused on right now. And that's kind of, you know, like to get into some schools, get into, you know, different groups, and just, you know, people have questions. The dogs tend to be a good icebreaker. And I think, you know, just demonstrate to the blind insided that it's a characteristic, but it doesn't have to be as limiting as they probably might think it needs to be.
Right, right. I love that. And the fact you're raising funds and awareness, you know, for multiple efforts, whether it's guide dogs or kind of the adaptive sports side of things. Really neat combination. Okay, and so I'm curious if you want to share any contact info as far as your website, if anyone's interested in getting in touch.
Yeah, I mean, if you go out to Blind Canine Sports, I believe there's a contact us page there, I believe, and it's just blindcaninesports@gmail.com is an email that would work as well. You know, I probably should be on or try to get on more media. I'm kicking it kind of old school. I just got a little blog and I post out there occasionally. I try to put some highlights of when something interests me, or, you know, I've had some success, or if we get the opportunity to speak. You know, I appreciate this opportunity because, you know, hopefully it'll motivate somebody to get out and you know, pursue athletics at whatever level they so desire. You know, I do have I cherish the opportunity to not speak at different groups. Whenever I get that, it's always always learn something about myself at the same time. Back in 1998, I was doing the running the New York City Marathon, and I actually got Ricky Cox was my guide, and he had won the Cowtown three different times, and he was in the 84 Olympic trials, and so he was, you know, he was a great running guide, and he was able, you know, he was so much faster than me that he had no trouble keeping up. He worked for the Fort Worth Transportation Authority and the bus system, and he asked me to come do a little lunch and learn or a motivational talk to their fitness center. They're doing a membership drive. Anything to give back to somebody that's helping you out, right? And so I went and did my talk, and we did two, three different sessions, and we kept running and training, and I'd ask him at about every training run about this lady that named Wendy that ran that fitness center. And it was like, I don't know if she has a boyfriend or not, Mike. And he kept kind of putting me off. And then about a couple of weeks later, she mentioned to him, hey, you know, do you think Mike would, you know, does he have a girlfriend or anything? Once she showed interest in me, then he put us in contact, and we got married then in October of 2000. So I'm not going to say my speeches will change your life, but that one definitely changed mine for the best.
Right, right. You never know, right? Awesome. Well, again, our guest here on this episode has been Mike Royal. And Mike, really, really appreciate the time. Again, thanks so much for initially reaching out to me, making contact, getting to meet up, and really enjoyed your stories and just sharing your life story here on the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. And hopefully maybe we can get together for lunch when I'm back down there in September in that Urbandale. I believe it's between Tampa and Orlando, so I don't think it'd be too far away from where you're living now. And if anybody out there, I mean, right now, my main thing, like I say, is the blind water scan. So anybody that wants to give that a try, there's organizations probably locally that can help get you on the water. But if you want to try taking it to the competitive level, hit me up and I'll glad to share any knowledge I can to hopefully make you successful.
Absolutely. All righty. Sounds great. Thanks again, Mike. Really appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you.
To hear more episodes of the Eyes Free Sports podcast and to subscribe, search for Eyes Free Sports on your favorite podcast platform or visit eyesfreesports.com. Be sure to follow the Eyes Free Sports podcast at facebook.com/eyesfreesports and on Twitter @eyesfreesports.